It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The state Senate unanimously approved legislation last year that would give the governor the authority to declare public health emergencies. This was many months before the coronavirus epidemic erupted in China. The sponsor, Senate Democratic Leader Jay Costa, has sent a letter to House Republican leaders to again consider passing the measure. Senator Costa, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Kevin. Happy to be with you.
Your bill's been sitting in the House Health Committee for 8 months. What's holding it back?
The pushback is I believe that there are some who believe that the governor already has the authority to declare emergencies, which he clearly does. And he's utilizing that ability to do it, what is usually deemed to be for more emergencies along the lines of tornadoes and hurricanes or whatever the case may be, snowstorms, things of that nature, when floods and droughts and large landslides, et cetera. That's what the emergency declaration is really not meant for. It's meant for these very specific types of instances where you have something like the coronavirus in place. What we're looking at is looking to put together a, which the Senate has unanimously agreed, that we should have a public health emergency that better equips us with responding quickly to share information, maybe coordinate treatment strategies, do a whole host of other things in this space when you have this type of situation arising, this type of a virus in our Commonwealth.
Senator, you mentioned the governor has powers. In fact, he declared an emergency in January of 2018. It had to do with the opioid crisis and even referred to that as a health crisis. So why is your public health emergency legislation needed if he can declare such an emergency regarding the opioid crisis?
Largely, it's because the health emergency is a different nature than what was intended and designed by the other type of emergency declarations. This is very specifically designed for the opioid crisis. In fact, when we introduced it in in early 2018 and in the past, it was precisely for that purpose. Having the appropriate health emergency declaration in place is better suited to be able to address the health needs that are taking place.
Well, let's get to some of those things. According to your bill, Senate Bill 633, if a health emergency is declared, it would last 90 days. Possibly be renewed, would authorize the Department of Health to waive regulations or create new ones. What do you mean by regulations?
Being able to possibly circumvent, where necessary, the lengthy process to enact regulations. Regulation enactment in this Commonwealth and many other states is a very time-consuming, laborious process. This would allow the Department of Health being able to shortcut some of those circumstances to be able to get regulations out that allow for certain agencies, certain entities, certain people who the agencies will be coordinating with to be able to take steps that would otherwise not be able to do at that point in time.
Can you give me an example of a possibility?
So one of the things that you can think about would be maybe some of the data collection as it relates to some of these viruses, for example, in this case, something along those lines, that gathering data, being able to empower the agencies to contract with different organizations and individuals to be able to address what's taking place with respect to a particular situation. This would allow us the opportunity to be able to make quick decisions about what needs to be done to address and deal with a public health emergency.
According to the language of the bill, information collected by the state would not be subject to our right to know law. Why shouldn't the public have access to this information?
I think it's a situation where you have to be careful about what the information might be and what harm may further arise from maybe what's taking place there. Now, there are a variety of ways that a variety of instances where the public health emergency declaration would come into play. It's not limited to, for example, to viruses or things of that nature. But there may be information, there may be solutions, there may be actions that may not necessarily be in the best interest of the public to be able to know that. For example, if for some reason we are faced with a public emergency where somebody is infiltrated our water systems and is putting in things into the water, the strategy that we might employ to be able to counteract that may not be in the best interest of the public to know or the bad guys to know how we're going to counteract that.
I'm talking to State Senator Jay Costa. So no movement since June. Have you had conversations with House Health Committee Chair Representative Kathy Rapp?
I have not had a direct conversation with Representative Rapp. I have had conversations with Speaker Terzai. But what prompted me to renew this call has been that the governor's office is putting in plans in place with the Department of Health. We know what the CDC is telling us with respect to the threat of the coronavirus. What we need to do is take steps to be able to address that, but also more importantly, have the tools, the legislative or regulatory tools in place to be able to move forward quickly to react what's taking place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the CDC is telling us that it's inevitable, that it's going to be in this country to a much greater degree. We need to be prepared for that. And that's all I'm trying to achieve here.
There's one line in the summary that I'm curious about. It says the bill will provide immunity from liability. What does that mean?
I think that in terms of some things that folks would do if we would contract with folks, that if we would contract with agencies, for example, based upon the waiver of the regulations, whatever may take place, that there would be immunity, because if we're directing an agency or an agency is directing an entity or an organization or a nonprofit or somebody to take certain steps or a hospital, whatever the case might be, that they would be, you know, in hindsight, it may not necessarily be the best set of circumstances to address an emergency health crisis, whether it be, as I mentioned, the coronavirus or whether it would be somebody, you know, poisoning our water systems. How you react to that may at the time be the best practice, but in the end may not necessarily be what the outcome may be would have been desired. At the end of the day, you worry after the fact about liability issues. It was intended to be able to let folks exercise what they deem to be the appropriate steps at the appropriate time and not have sort of like armchair quarterbacking, looking back and saying, you were wrong when you did this. It was about the reaction at the point in time that you're dealing with the issue that is important.
Do you think with all of the concern about the coronavirus that the House will now call a vote on it? Is that why you called attention to it again, even though this bill passed months ago?
There's no question. The reason I'm calling the attention is, again, I want to be able to provide to the Commonwealth another tool to help them address what needs to be done and to be able to make decisions in a timely and quick fashion. That's why I'm saying now, please, let's do this now so we can address it now. Or do we have to wait for the next type of crisis to come along?
Do you think that the House will call for a vote, though, on it?
I hope they do. I can't sit here and say to you, Kevin, that they're going to call for a vote. My hope is that they understand the purpose behind the legislation and they understand the timeliness of the event and how it's not appropriate for us to use the typical emergency declaration that's typically used for infrastructure damage and things of that nature, and yet be able to define emergency health declarations that are better suited to address the issue that we're trying to deal with, that health emergency.
Have you been in touch with Allegheny County agencies? The airport, Port Authority, this program reached out to Pittsburgh International, but officials declined to talk about their action plan at this time. A reminder, of course, many thousands of people stroll through that airport every day. Are they and others talking to you?
I have not spoken directly with the agencies you referenced, but I've not heard directly from Port Authority or, more importantly, from the airport, which I think is a major group of folks that we need to be able to sit down and talk with.
Allegheny County, of course, is your home county. Will you be checking up on those other agencies?
Yes,
to make sure they are in
absolutely
touch with the State Department of Health?
Yes, I will confirm that. I believe that to be the case, but you've raised this issue, and I will confirm it, that they are, in fact, doing that, having those conversations, and see where things go in that regard.
Senate Democratic Leader Jay Costa, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Kevin. Enjoyed our conversation.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. So our state government cannot declare a public health emergency. So what preparations are in the works? I'm joined in studio by WESA's Sarah Bowden and Megan Harris. No cases of coronavirus have been reported in Pennsylvania. But Sarah, what have you learned about our hospitals' preparations?
Well, the hospitals say they are preparing. They're making sure that they have the appropriate protective equipment, and they are also, I'm being told, at least by AHN, being judicious about how they use that protective equipment so they don't go through their supply too quickly. They have screenings for both patients and staff who have recently traveled. They're making sure that their isolation rooms are up and running, so they're doing more monitoring and testing to make sure those are functioning. So they're just getting prepared in case they have to take care of sick people.
So preparations for both staff and the patients.
Yes.
Right. The State Department of Health says it won't have the necessary equipment to test for coronavirus till later this week. Right now, any suspected samples have to be sent to the CDC. So say a doctor's office or a first responder comes across something exhibiting someone concerning symptoms. What happens next?
Well, offices can test to make sure that some of the more typical viruses that are circulating right now. So you can test to make sure that it's something that's more common. So if it is negative for a more common thing, then they can, or if it's positive for a more common thing, at least they can rule out, you know, a more common virus. Then if it's possibly coronavirus, but a person isn't very sick, they may be sent home, because we have to remember that for most of the people infected with coronavirus, they recover at home. They don't need to go to the hospital.
Megan, what about first responders? How are they being prepared? Equipment, training, what?
So Wendell Hisrick, the public safety director for the city, has said that they're providing masks, gloves, protective equipment. They are doing that training perspective as well. He says, quote, "We will be prepared." They're trying to identify possible symptoms and to a degree working with suburban and county public bureaus as well. We should note, like I said, Pennsylvania doesn't exactly have the ability to test just yet. So we'll see how that works out whenever we get more information later this week.
Right. The equipment's supposed to arrive in the state labs later this week.
Yeah, in Chester County.
The city actually has a pandemic operations plan. I understand that's not a public document. Do we know what it might include?
So the city, county, dozens of stakeholders met in 2006, roughly, to talk about what that could look like. They had had operations plans in the past, but this, at the time, was being designed kind of around an influenza. They talked a lot about what it would look like in a worst-case scenario, but also like how they would work with individual agencies. That included some interesting concerns from some of those stakeholders. PNC and Mellon Financial, for example, talked about how they would help people get access to their money through ATMs and other methods. UPMC was developing plans for quote-unquote graceful degradation of services in case hospitals just didn't have enough staff or space or medical equipment to treat everybody. Giant Eagle was worried about rationing, warehouse space, the availability of commercial drivers to move goods from place to place. And we should say that all of these companies were talking about remote work or staffing on site, what was crucial to keep going. And of course, the technology has evolved quite a bit since 2006.
So. And Sarah, health officials are using those widespread flu models to help them prepare, are they not?
I don't know.
Because of the virus, because they already have models in place. So
yes. I understand what you're asking now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So exactly. So we know that, for example, big gatherings,
right,
not a good idea. So perhaps you want to work from home. Maybe you postpone really big events like sports events. Maybe you suspend school for a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Because the bigger the group, the more likely the virus, any kind of virus, will be to travel to more people.
Right.
And Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto said last week that the city, through its public safety department, would have that authority to enforce a quarantine or take over the hospitals in a worst case scenario. And that would ultimately mean attempting to control people's movements in and out of the city. But to go back to that old document from 2006, at the time, the health department estimated that any attempt at restriction would result in a roughly 90% 90% of people would actually adhere to it. So that's still, if you do the math, about 30,000 rule breakers in our midst at any given moment.
And moving people around. That brings us to transportation. Megan, you've been in touch with the Airport Authority and the Port Authority of Allegheny County. What have you learned from them?
So Airport Authority officials declined to be a part of this conversation, but they reported on their own website, quote, "Officials are ready to implement an action plan as necessary." The U.S. State Department has warned American citizens not to travel to China. Those who are returning from the country are being diverted to one of 11 domestic airports. PIT is not one of those 11. And Port Authority, for its part, spokesperson Adam Brandolf said that officials are closely monitoring info from Fed, state, local officials, that safety is, of course, their highest priority. But they have about 220,000 unique rides a day. So the pandemic plan is a big part of what they're looking at right now, updating internal documents and making sure that, you know, the buses, the minibuses, the light rails, access cars, they would know how to disinfect all of them and work with their employees to be sure that they were taking care of themselves as well.
A little over a minute left. Quickly, another big gathering locations, schools. What's happening, whether it's universities or school districts? What do we know?
Well, a lot of universities are telling students to not travel to certain countries or self-isolate. For example, if they've been to Italy or Iran, places like that, including China and South Korea. Also, maybe if coronavirus does come to Pittsburgh and it's widespread, you know, schools might be suspended for a period of time.
Mm-hmm. Health and public safety officials are holding a press briefing later today. I'd like to know what each of you will be listening for in this.
I guess I will be listening to figure out, I want to know a little bit more about, since we can't test for coronavirus at this time, I want to know what the plan is. I want more details around that.
Megan?
I think I'll be listening for temperance. You know, we talk a lot about worst case scenarios and a best plan. You have it to be safe, but you don't necessarily always need it. So what will that look like, and what kinds of calm words will we hear in the next few minutes?
And briefly, Sarah, that's just stayed calm.
Coronavirus is not in Pennsylvania yet. Not time to panic, but time to prepare. So go to the grocery store, stock up in case you have to be at home for a little while. But don't panic.
Sarah Bowden and Megan Harris both report for WESA. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Pennsylvania General Assembly passes the Act for the Gradual Abolition of Slavery in 1780. The legislation was the first act abolishing the practice of slavery through the democratic process. It prohibited slaves being brought into Pennsylvania and made existing slave owners register those they enslaved. It also required that all people born in the state were automatically free, regardless of their race. The act did not free slaves, but gradually phased out the practice. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
WYEP celebrates Women's History Month throughout March. Today, find out about Kim Gordon. Born in Rochester, New York in 1953 and raised in Los Angeles, Kim Gordon moved to New York City in 1980 to pursue a career in art after college. There, she met Thurston Moore and formed Sonic Youth. The bandmates married in 1984 and released six independent albums before the decade was over. Sonic Youth made their major label debut in 1990 when DGC Records released Goo, their first commercial hit. Gordon has produced records, acted in films, and designed clothing while always maintaining a presence in the world of visual arts. Sonic Youth released their final studio album, The Eternal, in 2009, and Gordon and Moore divorced in 2013. To hear full songs from all of our featured artists for Women's History Month, go to WYEP.org/women.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Governor Tom Wolf wants to take about $200 million away from the horse racing industry and pay for college scholarships instead. Most notably, the state would no longer provide money to boost prizes that owners receive if their horses win a race. PA Post's Ed Mahan reports that while it might be easy to dismiss outrage from some wealthy horse owners, people in the industry are worried the loss will trickle down and hurt farmers.
Workers here at Hanover Shoe Farms are leading big brown mares and young foals from the fields into stalls. There are four new foals on this 94-year-old Adams County farm. Farm manager Patty Murphy helped one of the mares with her delivery.
Like around 6:30, taking my trash out, and I heard her water break. And I was like, oh boy, another baby.
Murphy has worked here for 20 years and lived on the property for eight. Seeing the babies born is still her favorite part.
Front feet sticking out, and then the nose, and it's a miracle, really. It's pretty awesome to witness.
But there is something worrying Murphy.
We'll be out of jobs here.
She and other workers breed and raise horses for racing. But now the entire horse racing industry says it's under threat in Pennsylvania. That's because Democratic Governor Tom Wolf wants to take away about $200 million the state provides to the industry. If those dollars go away, Murphy worries that owners won't want to spend money to buy horses, and this farm eventually won't have a reason to exist.
At my point in time in my career, I'm 10 years probably from retirement, and I've done this all my life. So it would be, you know, something I would have to find a new career path.
The debate over money for horse racing goes back to 2003.
I do solemnly swear. I, Edward G. Rendell, do solemnly swear...
After becoming governor, Rendell pushed for a gambling expansion. He proposed bringing tens of thousands of slot machines into the state. Some of the revenue would go to property tax relief, while another portion would support the horse racing industry. The thinking was that as people gambled more on slot machines, they would spend less betting on races.
To get the votes, there was an agreement that was reached.
Todd Mosteller represents horse owners and trainers. He says the compromise was between the state, casinos, and the racehorse industry.
Without those three entities agreeing on a percentage of distribution of revenues, we didn't have the votes for passage.
The expansion did pass. Now, whenever people lose money at slot machines, a portion of that flows back to the state, and a portion of that eventually flows to the racehorse industry. Over the years, some state lawmakers proposed using money earmarked for the racing industry for other things. But the idea didn't get far. Maybe that's a testament to the power of lobbying. Or maybe lawmakers in PA don't want to take money away from an industry with a strong connection to farms and farmers. But now, Democratic Governor Tom Wolf is giving the idea a major push.
Let's bet on our kids instead of bankrolling racehorse owners and ensure the viability of the Pennsylvania state system of higher education.
In this year's budget address, Wolf proposed the idea of taking the $200 million and using it for college scholarships instead. Since then, he has traveled across the state promoting it.
How important is the cost of higher education?
That includes a stop at Carlisle High School in Cumberland County. He spoke to one student who chose Gettysburg College, a private school, over the state-owned Indiana University of Pennsylvania, known as IUP. Gettysburg will cost the family about $5,000 more for the first year.
As her mom had IUP.
Jackie Holquist says Wolf's proposed scholarship could have changed their minds.
If that plan were in place, we would have definitely...
So it would have made a difference.
Would have definitely made a difference because it's an awesome school.
Yeah.
She would be in the honors program there, which would make it competitive with Gettysburg academically.
Right.
Yeah. Holquist's family has to cut back its budget to help cover tuition. But it still seems daunting.
We haven't taken vacation in years, saving for their college. I don't see us ever taking vacations if we have to pay $60,000 in debt.
The average graduate in Pennsylvania who borrows money finishes college with more than $37,000 in student loan debt. Meanwhile, the governor says many horse race owners don't even live in the state.
We have spent $2 billion of taxpayer money to private businesses over the last, since 2004.
And he says the industry can figure out a way to survive on its own.
That should be working on their own at some point. Let's do it now.
Back at the Adams County farm, Jim Simpson disagrees. He's chairman of Hanover Shoe Farms.
If this legislation goes through intact, it's going to force us to consider houses instead of horses. It's that simple. We've got 3,000 acres here.
That means they would shut down breeding operations and sell their land. While Wolf's plan keeps some money for horse racing, including $8 million for health and pension benefits, it eliminates breeding incentives, drug testing, and state funding for purses. That's the prize money owners receive for winning races. Simpson says those winnings pay for breeders, veterinarians, as well as salaries and health care for a bunch of other people.
The expenses are in Pennsylvania, not where the owner lives. And they plow it. Anybody that earns money in this state, I would have to say, or in the industry, just plows it all back in.
Simpson's farm had a payroll of $3.2 million last year and paid about $4.1 million to businesses across the region. One of the biggest expenses, nearly $900,000 that went to a nearby hay supplier. On this afternoon, a dozen workers are unloading 10.5 tons of hay into barns.
Our grandfather started, so we're the third generation.
Kyle Arntz likes not being stuck in an office.
And we don't just take handouts from everybody like seems like a lot of the world does today.
Of course, some people see the slot machine money that trickles down to this hay supplier as a handout to the racing industry. But Kyle doesn't.
I don't know. We go out and put our hearts into it and work our tails off every day.
How much of this work they'll be doing next year, or even if they'll be doing it, will be influenced by the decisions lawmakers make in the state capitol in the lead-up to the budget deadline in June. How that goes, well, that's anyone's bet. Ed Mahan, PA Post, Conewaga Township, Adams County.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The opioid crisis has struck thousands of Pennsylvanians over the last several years. But it's the individual, personal crisis caused by drugs that Sojourner House deals with on a daily basis. Veteran behavior health therapist Danita Benjamin Miller took over as executive director of Sojourner House 4 months ago. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you.
Danita, for nearly three decades, Sojourner House has been providing recovery services for women and their children. But how has the opioid crisis increased demand for your services?
Well, Sojourner House is unique because we provide 14 apartment units for women to bring three kids under the age of 12 with them for treatment. And we're one of the only long-term treatment programs where a woman can stay from 3 to 6 months in care. While she's in care, we connect them to medication assistant treatment if they are diagnosed with an opioid use disorder. Mm-hmm. That's essential because over the last decade in Allegheny County, there have been over 5,000 overdoses due to opioid use.
We had fatal overdoses.
Fatal, mm-hmm. fatal. And we also provide Narcan upon admission. We also have Narcan kits on each floor of our unit to make sure that our staff, but also our clients, are trained on how to use Narcan if someone was to overdose on site.
Mm-hmm. Because of this increased demand, have you had to turn people away?
We haven't turned anyone away. We believe in providing warm referrals. That means that when someone calls, if we can't service them, we make sure they get connected to another provider. We have a close relationship with Family Links. That's where I came from prior to Sojourner House. And so we often refer to Family Links Family Treatment Center because they're also the same level of care.
How do people come your way? Is it through referrals? How do they get to Sojourner House?
Well, through some of them are self-referrals. Also through Department of Human Services, Drug and Alcohol. They can also call from their insurance company. We also get calls from Community Care, which is the local medication assistant provider. It's numerous avenues as far as the referral services.
Court system as well?
Court system. We also service those who are mandated to treatment. We will go to the court. We will also go to Allegheny County Jail and transport that person to treatment. Mm-hmm.
Danita, for those not familiar, Sojourner House has two main programs, drug and alcohol treatment and housing. Let's start with the treatment. What can that treatment include?
The treatment is comprehensive services from day one. So we believe in planning for discharge at admission. So one, we don't want any family exiting to homelessness. So it means identifying a housing plan. Two, they're connected to a therapist, so they receive individual therapy. They also receive group therapy, and they also have the chance to be connected to a peer mentor. We have a relationship with Power, who provide that service to our women who need someone who's walked that walk in recovery.
What's that length of treatment intended to be?
It's 3 to 6 months, and it takes about 3 to 6 months, actually, if someone has a chronic history of substance use disorder, just to be able to address some of the issues that's connected to their biological, even their social, and even what's going on with their brain.
And housing, it can be temporary, that 3 to 6 months, or even longer term. How do you decide which works best for that individual person, an individual client, and maybe her children?
And that's where our case management services come in. So we believe in coordinated treatment between our therapist and our case management team. So we want to make sure that, one, that we have a housing plan that will promote long-term recovery. Some others may come in, they may already have housing, and we want to make sure they maintain their housing. Some come in with no housing, so we use services through Allegheny Link, but also through other providers. But we sometimes utilize our own transitional housing program as a step down to make sure that the mother and her family has a place to go after care.
Some of your clients have multiple challenges, addiction, but housing insecurity, as you mentioned, it could be hunger, even abuse to deal with all at once. How do you get to the root of all those needs?
It takes a team. And it also takes building an authentic relationship with the clients that are honest about their needs. So it's not just about asking at admissions, but it's about engaging weekly to make sure that we're addressing all of their areas of needs It's about following up with community linkages to make sure that that family is touched in every area. It's making sure the child is connected to the right education system. It's about making sure the mom has, if needed, mental health services and medication, and also connected to physical health care. So we meet as a team. We want to make sure that that person feels that they're a part of the team, so we believe in inclusive care.
For clients who are the victims of abuse, can that abuse actually lead to or reinforce the addiction?
Yes, it can, because it's trauma. And if you don't have any type of trauma technique embedded into your treatment program, then oftentimes it's easy to miss when someone has a history of abuse or may have experienced something that may be related to post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm.
Your clients have children. How do you help mothers get better, but also help improve their parenting skills?
We have a wonderful parenting staff. If I could give shout outs, I would to Liz and to Sydney. They are wonderful. They do a lot of engagement with the parents. They model for the parents on how to build healthy relationships and just let the kids know, just because they may have witnessed addiction, that doesn't mean it has to be their future. But we also let the parents know that their history does not have to be their present or their future. So not to parent out of guilt or shame, but to parent out of hope.
The children are living there as well. Do you have services? What do you provide for the kids themselves? Is there ever any space to just have fun, to be kids?
Yes, we have our child care center, and we also have our child care staff. They make sure that there are center children activities. They want to make sure that the child has actually been connected to any type of educational activities or any type of activities that will improve their social relationships. But the most important thing is our volunteers. We have a park that's right outside of one of our units that could not have been done without volunteers. And so that engagement of volunteers, our staff, we want to make sure that we minimize the trauma for any child and also the mother who received care.
Trying to make it as normal as possible
as
for the kids?
As normal as it can be.
We're speaking with Danita Benjamin Miller, Executive Director of Sojourner House. You most recently served as Director of Behavior Health for Family Links, which takes sort of a holistic family approach to mental health. You're also a licensed clinical social worker. How has this work helped prepare you for this new chapter?
Well, being a social worker, you're taught early on that it's important to be an advocate and to always want to enhance someone's life. My position as Director of Behavioral Health for Family Links, my main motivation was enhancing the lives of our clients, enhancing the lives of the staff, but also making sure we create sustainable programs that would be around to make sure that families receive the best care. So I believe that experience and my values that I have as a social worker has really helped me with my transition as the executive director for Sojourner House.
All right, so I mentioned 4 months. Have you made any changes yet that you're especially proud of that you want to point to?
Yes, I am. I'm very proud of, we decided to do some restructuring. We did not do any layoffs. What we did was that we make sure that the titles fit the mission and the values of the program. So our direct care staff, for example, they are so valuable to the women in our treatment program, and their title was program aide. So I changed their title along with the executive team to recovery support specialists, because they are recovery supports. They're the ones providing the informal counseling. They're the ones really connecting to the clients. So it promotes a therapeutic milieu.
The organization founded in 1991, nearly 3 decades. How do you hope to build on that legacy going forward?
With the help of our stakeholders, with the help of our staff and our board, I'm hoping that we can expand Sojourner House and Sojourner House Moms to expand our treatment program, to maybe include some outpatient care. Also with our Sojourner House Moms, which is our housing program, to expand more housing units in Allegheny County to prevent homelessness, but also to make sure that families that are experiencing mental health and drug and alcohol are getting the case management linkages that they need to live a good life.
Sojourner House Moms, about how many people can you accommodate right now?
We accommodate on average close to 50 families a year. for Sojourner House Moms, and we have about 40 apartment units.
And that is more extended residential
opportunities. Correct.
For up to how long?
Three of our units is 3 years for permanent housing, and one unit is 1 year for transitional.
How do you help a client dream, sort of take a breath to reset and imagine a better future for themselves?
I have tea with the clients every month. And a part of my agenda during a tea is to motivate clients not to allow their addiction be their identification. I always tell them, this is something that you're experiencing. It's not the total identity of who you are. So I encourage them to work through their addiction. I also let them know it is a disease. It's biopsychosocial, and treat it as a disease. If we treat it as a disease model, then we can create more hope for our clients and their more motivation to change and have success in their recovery.
When is somebody ready to be discharged, to say goodbye?
Well, for our treatment program, it's anywhere from 3 to 6 months. So it's when that mother has achieved her treatment goals, along with the treatment team being a support, and also making sure that that mother have a good housing plan, a positive housing plan for her and her children so that she can maintain her sobriety. For our moms program, it is when a family has achieved self-sufficiency, when we know we connected them to more permanent housing, which is long-term, and also increasing their income, whether it be employment or maybe through Social Security benefits.
Is there any additional support once clients leave, a friendly face, someone to lean on?
Yes, our door is never closed. We believe in following up with clients. When someone is discharged, we call, see how they're doing. But if they show up at our doorstep, we will offer the services. And if we can't provide it, we will get them connected to the most appropriate care.
Are you that friendly face?
I'm that friendly face. I really believe in client-centered therapy and approaches. I believe you have to go where the client is and engage them and meet them where they are.
Danita Benjamin Miller is the executive director of Sojourner House. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And for today, that is the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the Americans with Disabilities Act was adopted 30 years ago to eliminate discrimination against people with disabilities in jobs, schools, access to all places open to the public. How has Pittsburgh complied? We'll talk with the author of the ADA, former Congressman Tony Quello. You can find us online anytime at wesa.fm/confluence. This and every episode of the program is available via podcast. Download, rate, and review us wherever you tune in. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.